Ask the Minister Sunday. I love doing this. I always appreciate getting your questions and having an opportunity to answer them as best I can. I always feel that I need to start with a caveat. That is, I'm not telling you what to believe. I'm not telling you what to think today. I am sharing what I believe Unity teaches and to some degree what I believe. So everyone gets to make up their own mind. You make your own choices about your own beliefs. So with that caveat, here we go. So our first question comes from Nick Flores, sitting right over there. And he says, does Unity believe that all methods, such as Islam, Christianity, Buddhism, Hinduism, are equal and valid paths to spiritual union with God? So the answer is yes. It needs a little bit of explanation, though. So every Sunday I say we honor all paths to God, all names for God, all expressions of God. And it's very much a part of Unity philosophy to honor whatever spiritual path people follow in that sort of ascension of consciousness. What we say is that if Unity resonates with you, we love having you here, we welcome you here. If Unity doesn't resonate with you, we always encourage people to find a path that does, right? But that one part of his question, do we believe that all are equal and valid paths to spiritual union, what I would say about that is that we don't judge other paths. We don't look at others and say, well, you're good, you're not good, you're equal, you're valid, okay, you're all right. We really spend our time on our philosophy. When we do speak about another path, it would tend to be to contrast with traditional Christianity, just because we also consider ourselves Christian-based, and we want to draw the contrast between that. But in terms of honoring and respecting and even encouraging all paths to spiritual union with God, the answer is yes. Okay, this came in anonymously on the website. I really liked your message of the five golden doors, but then I started wondering if what you want to be manifested and you believe will be manifested is harmful to you or to others. The Hitler question. Does the universe only allow good manifestations, or is this an explanation of why there's unhappiness and pure evil, parentheses, really bad choices, in the world? There's a lot of ideas in here, so I'm going to kind of tease it apart a little bit. First of all, let me just revisit what the five doors was about. That was a talk I gave, I think it was October the 17th. And the five golden doors were five principles, if you will, that if we understood them and applied them in our lives, we could demonstrate more abundant living, greater prosperity, greater good in our lives. The doors were everything I want is available. Excuse me. You'll manifest as much as you believe is available. You'll manifest as much as you believe you deserve. You'll manifest as much as you ask for. You will manifest as much as you are willing to invest in, and you will manifest as much as you are willing to accept. So that's what the five golden doors were about. The reality is that we all have this power within us. We all have these innate divine powers within us. Whether we use them for good or for ill is a product of our own choices and our own free will. We have been given free will. And that accounts for what shows up in the world and in our lives. There is no greater power out there. There is no God super being that is pulling the strings or making decisions. Well, I think I'll let this show up, or no, I don't think I'm going to let that show up. Were that the case, I would venture to say we would not have had the Holocaust. We would not have had perhaps 9/11, slavery, racism, genocide, all these things that are a product of the choices that human beings have made exercising their free will. What I would say about that is everyone's on their own path. And so the bottom line is, how are you using your powers? It's not necessarily relevant to get worried about how other people are using theirs, but how are you using yours? How are you using that divine power within you, and what are you manifesting? Are you manifesting good? Are you manifesting prosperity and abundance and harmony and love? Or are you sowing discord? What are you doing with the powers that you have been given? Let's see if there was anything else I wanted to say about that. Let me get some water here. I do think that we need to be careful when we start labeling people as good or bad, that some people set out with good intentions and some people set out with bad intentions. It's my personal belief that nobody wakes up, now I'm leaving out mental illness here, there could be severe mental illness where this would happen, where somebody wakes up and says, I think I'm going to be a bad guy. I think I'm going to go out there and do bad things in the world. Typically, people feel they're trying to get their needs met, and in whatever way they're thinking, they've justified what they're doing. If they didn't have a justification for it, they wouldn't do it. So I just want to be careful about that kind of dualistic thinking where some of us are doing good things and some of us are doing bad things. And again, what I would say is stick to your own knitting and how you are applying these principles in your life, because we need them. We need more people like you and you who are applying them to good. Okay, on to the next one. Oops, I skipped one. This is a good one. Is it necessary to suffer to achieve higher consciousness? This one comes from Marsha Austin. And she cites Matthew chapter 10, verse 38, that says, whoever does not take up the cross and follow me is not worthy of me. So I did some research on this one. First of all, about that scripture passage. And what the scholars say about that is that it's very likely did not come from Jesus, but was rather words put into his mouth from the later Christians, the evangelists. And the clue to that is that they make a reference to the cross. They're really making a reference to the crucifixion. Well, he hadn't been crucified. He was doing his ministry. He was living his life. So for him to be talking about the cross at that early stage makes us think that that came in from later writers and was added into that gospel. But to the larger point, do we have to suffer to become enlightened? My answer would be no, again with an explanation. Because to me, we all suffer, we all experience pain and hardship in our lives. But I really stick to the saying, pain is inevitable, suffering is optional. I believe that we all encounter challenges in our lives in so many ways, and maybe always. That's how we grow. Is it not true? When you look back over the most difficult times in your life, that's probably where you had the biggest breakthrough or the biggest insight that helped you going forward. These challenges that occur in our path, as we like to say, the obstacles in your path are not in the way. They are the way. How you address those challenges, how you grow in the face of them, is what feeds your spiritual growth. So I would say the challenges and to some degree pain is necessary for our evolution, our spiritual evolution. But suffering, again, is optional, because suffering, at least in my mind now, suffering occurs when we go over it and over it, and it becomes part of our sort of identity. And to me, the suffering results when we relinquish our own power to overcome. And so some pain, you would say, is irreversible, right? There's some things that we can't physically change, for example, a person's body. But we can always change our attitude. We can always change the way we're looking at it. We can always change so that we see ourselves as whole and overcomers rather than victims. Because I believe when we see ourselves as victims and we relinquish our power is when we truly suffer. And I do not believe that that is necessary or even advisable on the spiritual path. I hope that makes sense. Let's see if I covered all that. I did want to share this one quote, which I think is relevant to this. One of my favorite books is Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. I know many of you have read that book. And here is a man who was in the concentration camps during World War II, just the most horrific conditions, the most terrible injustice and oppression and pain. but he was able to come through that experience, and he wrote about it in his book. And this is what he says: everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's way. And that, I believe, is where we find our power. All right. This is a really juicy one. This is one I'm going to spend the most time on. What is Unity's view of the Gospel of Thomas? From Judy Namath. Thank you, Judy. So many of us have talked about the Gospel of Thomas before. We know it to be one of the Gnostic Gospels. The Gnostic Gospels were Gospels that were not included in the Bible canon. A great cache of them was found in Nag Hammadi, Egypt in 1945, buried. They had been buried so that they would not be seized in those days in the late first and early second century. Those who did not abide by Orthodox beliefs were considered heretics and their lives were at risk. The Gospel of Thomas was one of those texts found in the Nag Hammadi Library. It is often cited and probably heard about more than any of the others because it is the most complete. So there are not so many missing pages, and it kind of holds together better. It is said to have been recorded by Didymus Judas Thomas, the brother, possibly the twin brother, of Jesus. Now just remember, people would write in a name even if they weren't that person. They would say this was the testimony of so-and-so or the Gospel of Matthew or whatever it was, but it wasn't actually Matthew writing it. You know that, right? So that could well be the case here. Gnostic simply means knowledge or insight. And for the Gnostics, the spiritual journey was about discovering and experience the kingdom of God within them. They were more interested in the teachings of Jesus than what the Orthodox Church came to teach about Jesus. So in this way, they were very compatible with what we teach in Unity, because we are in a new thought for overall, because we are more interested in the teachings of Jesus and how to apply those in our lives than, say, the teachings of teachings about Jesus from the church, of the traditional church. But the Gospel of Thomas is so important that it is one that the 300 distinguished gospel scholars in the Jesus Seminar, you've heard me talk about that. This was a gathering of 300 of the highest ranking Bible scholars got together. They spent 6 years poring over the four canonical gospels and the Gospel of Thomas to use their collective wisdom, their research, everything they could get their hands on to determine whether this was what Jesus truly said. You know, the red letter that you find in the Gospels. They were trying to find out, to their best judgment, what did he actually say and what words were put in his mouth later by others. The fact that they included the Gospel of Thomas in here says what high esteem they held it in. We in New Thought consider it to be original, authentic, and directly tied to what Jesus said. It has 114 sayings in it that are considered to be sort of enigmatic, kind of the hidden sayings, kind of esoteric. And there are some of them that really beautifully align with New Thought. For example, saying 24, there is light within a person of light, and it shines on the whole world. Saying 25, Jesus said, love your brother like your soul. Protect that person like the pupil of your eye. Saying 113, his followers said to him, and you've heard this before, but you may not have known it originated in seems to have originated in Thomas. His followers said to him, when will the kingdom come? He responded, it will not come by watching for it. It will not be said, look, here it is, or look, there it is. Rather, the Father's kingdom is spread out upon the earth, and people do not see it. So great, now you're ready to go out and get a copy of the Gospel of Thomas. What I want to tell you, though, is there's some other sayings in there that are weird. There's some other sayings in there that are strange, that can even be a little offensive. One of them, saying 7, lucky is the lion that the human will eat, so that the lion becomes human, and foul is the human that the lion will eat, and the lion still will become human. Okay. There's a lot to, the Jesus seminar just said, this saying is obscure. There's a lot to sort out there. And then this one, saying 14, this one really threw me. It says, if you fast, you will bring sin upon yourselves. And if you pray, you will be condemned. And if you give to charity, you will harm your spirits. Right. What the scholars say is they think that was meant to be sort of a radical criticism of popular piety and sort of the ostentatious practice, these ostentatious practices, religious practices. But right, it really throws you, doesn't it? So it's a little bit of a mixed bag. So when we look at the Gospel of Thomas from the New Thought perspective, there are a couple of aspects of it that are truly exciting, even above and beyond anything written in particular sayings. One is that it reminds us that there were other Gospels written around the time of Jesus that were not included in the Bible canon. They were purposely not included because they did not conform to the story that the church wanted to tell. Second, Thomas was a sayings gospel. All it is the sayings of attributed to Jesus. It doesn't include any narrative. It doesn't talk about a virgin birth or any circumstances around his death or resurrection. There's nothing like that in there. It is all sayings. And what makes that particularly relevant is the third point, that scholars believe the Gospel of Thomas predated the canonical Gospels. They predated Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So you could begin to see how the sayings existed first, the focus perhaps being on Jesus' teachings, and then others came along in later decades and layered on some popular narratives around death, or birth, death, resurrection, etc. From a Bible study standpoint, that's the real significance of the Gospel of Thomas, that it can be traced, parts of it can be traced to as early as 50 or 60 of the Common Era. So that would have been like 20 years ago, or 20 years or so after Jesus' death. When you look at Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the earliest of those was written, I think it was 40 years after his death, and then 70 and 90. So we're talking significant difference in the timing of it. So of course we would tend to think what was written closer to the time of his life and death would have more authenticity. I first heard about the Gospel of Thomas from Reverend Dr. Mary Tumpkin giving a paper in 2006 or 2007, and she said this, a paper at an INTA, a New Thought conference, and I came right out of my chair when I heard her talk about the Gospel of Thomas. She said, in recent years, the Gospel of Thomas has gained the attention of many since its writings promote individual transformation. For those who seek to live a life of spiritual engagement, the Gospel of Thomas provides thought-provoking concepts that seekers of truth wrestle with as they encounter God and the kingdom right here. It offers by no means an easy course of development, but one that demands a strong commitment and devotion to the inner life. So that really resonates with what we are about here at Unity. All right, now for the lightning round. These are a little quicker questions and answers, several from John Cates. First, is Unity a denomination or a movement? What distinguishes one from the other? And if it is still considered a movement, are there any efforts to consider it a denomination? So from the beginning, it's been referred to as a movement, and that was very intentional on the part of our founders, Charles and Myrtle Fillmore. They did not want to create a church. They did not want to create a denomination. What they created was they wanted it to be sort of a meeting ground where people could go to their own churches during the morning and then come to Unity in the afternoon to talk about spiritual principles and truths that were common to all of them. So their whole focus was about teaching these sort of overarching principles that could be applied to our lives to completely transform our lives. When folks came along and said, but really we should have churches, people want to gather together, they want to worship, very reluctantly they agreed. And so Unity churches began to be formed. So that's when the term denomination started to be used, because denomination really applies more to a particular church. And so people still use that, but I personally still like movement better, because the point of the Fillmores was, we're not trying to be a big church. We're not trying to get a lot of people into churches. We're trying to get these principles out into the world where they can make the biggest difference. So that was the reason for calling it a movement. At the beginning of our Breakthrough Building Fund drive, we heard the new addition would be named after our first pastor, founding minister, Judith Meyer. When will we have the official naming and dedication? Also, will we have a wall recognizing our previous three, in my humble opinion, four, pastors? Each one laid a building block toward our continued success and should be recognized. So I'm so glad you asked this question. It served as a catalyst, and the board voted at its last meeting to go ahead and name the Fellowship Hall Meyer Hall, and we will dedicate that to her and install a sign in there that indicates such. Sometime in January, we want to complete the campaign, and then we will absolutely celebrate what we've created together and proceed with that. In terms of the plaque or wall recognizing previous pastors, I will leave that to the board. Let's see. I recognize the importance of becoming a member of Uni Renaissance. It does have its benefits, a sense of belonging, being at the top for me. My question pertains to why is it necessary to renew membership every year? My feeling is we renew our membership by pledging, by attending services, by participating in the various activities. I realize the need to know who the members are, but annually seems like overkill. So I really hear you on that. I know it comes around quickly. We do it in order to keep our files cleaned, in order to keep our database up to date. People move, people die, people remarry, divorce, etc. And we want to make sure that we have the up-to-date information. So that's why we do it annually. And the wonderful Alicia Flores has made it as easy as possible. It could not be easier now. She will send you an email that has your information in it. All you have to do is write a single word back to her, yes, and you are renewed. So that's the reason for that. I've noticed Silent Unity is no longer mentioned during our services. Is it still around? Thank you for asking the question. That's why it was in today. We talked about Silent Unity. We originally started talking about Silent Unity when we were all gone, when this was an empty sanctuary on Sundays because we were in lockdown. And people needed more prayer support than we didn't have prayer chaplains here. So we started telling people about Silent Unity. When we came back in the building and had chaplains here again, we stopped talking about Silent Unity. But your question reminded me that people are still watching online and people still need many different ways to get prayer support. So we've put that back in. Thanks to you. Thank you, John. This one is from Gail Kent. After having sung in church choirs for most of my adult life, I miss hearing and experiencing classical church music. I realize that some of the messaging in traditional music is not consistent with Unity values, but would it be possible to incorporate some of it into the service in other ways? Certainly Bach, Handel, and Mozart could at least provide instrumental and meditative music that would not be objectionable. While I love our choir and the songs used in the service, I feel that there is a wealth of music that could add depth to the spiritual experience at Unity. Here. Passing that over to you, Reverend Richard.
I heard it here. Could you repeat the question? I'm kidding. Okay. I agree that that great choral classical music is just so moving, and it really touches our, you know, that inner ancestral, you know, part of us. And currently, when we get our choir up to where we can go back to doing that, we will definitely do that. In the meantime, if we can have Bach, Handel, or Mozart come on in and play, I would love that, as you suggested. But in the meantime, you know, we could use that for background music. If we were going to do a dance or some kind of theatrical production, we could bring that in. And right now we're focused on the importance of our music matching our message so that when you leave here, you've got a solid idea and you can maybe even sing the message. So, you know, prior to 15 or 20 years ago, Unity did not have its own body of music, but we do now. And so we use, that's our focus during the service. And as far as meditation, even doing classical music behind meditation becomes distracting, because if you recognize the melody, it takes you away from the meditation. So I always improvise the meditation music so it doesn't break your concentration. So I hear that, and I will be looking for opportunities to present some more classical choral or otherwise classical music.
Thank you. Thank you, and thank you, Gail, for the question. Gail had another question for us. Why is there no directory of members for Unity Renaissance? Every other congregation of which I've been a member has one. I would very much like to have one to help me feel more a part of Unity. As a member who lives on the peninsula and finds it impossible to get to the service every week, it would be a huge help to be able to make contact with individual members and learn their names. I know there are other peninsula members, for example, but I don't know who they are and where they live. Is this a possibility? So this has been suggested a bunch. Many people would like us to have a directory again. I have some resistance to the idea of a print directory because we are bigger than something we can hand out in print now. Other people are involved in our service who aren't necessarily here. Also, the reality is that it goes out of date within probably a day of it being printed mm-hmm. because we have new people coming and going all of the time. However, we could have an online directory, and I think I've talked to Alicia about this. We think that would be a really great idea. We're updating our database. When we get it updated, we will be able to have a member directory that has people's names and the information they're willing to have shared about them. If we wanted to add photos into that, which I kind of got from the question was part of that, that's a bigger undertaking. So we would need somebody to organize that. And here's kind of the bottom line. This is a great idea. All we need is somebody to lead it. We need somebody to lead it and drive it and own it and make it happen. This is a big project. It's a worthwhile project. With all the staff have on their plates right now, I personally am not willing to put this on them as well, but we have incredible people here. This reminds me of the cookbook project. Everybody wanted a cookbook, and I'm like, oh my gosh, that's such a huge thing, and along came Ginger Zarsky, created a knockout team, went off, got her done, bam. So if you have an interest in this, not only being a part of it, but actually being the leader of it, please let me know, because I think it would be very worthwhile. And with that said, quite honestly, folks, there isn't anything we can't do here, or very little we can't do here, if somebody is willing to take charge of it and lead it and make it happen. You're empowered, remember? So think about what you would like to bring into our community. Final question from Jolene Zakowski. What, if anything, did the Fillmore say about the afterlife? Well, they didn't talk a lot about the afterlife because they were mostly concerned with the here and now. How do we live our lives in this iteration? But they did talk about it some. Certainly they did not endorse the idea of a traditional heaven and hell, that the saved go to heaven and the damned go to hell. More often in Unity we say heaven and hell are states of consciousness that we create here in this life. But they did talk about the afterlife, particularly with respect to reincarnation. So both of them believed in reincarnation, and Charles especially talked a lot about reincarnation. They both seem to have almost a Hindu view where you keep coming back and back until you reach the highest state of realization, and then your reincarnation is complete. For them, that meant rising into Jesus consciousness or Christ consciousness, we would say, achieving full realization. But Charles talked about this a lot more. Charles actually let it be known that he felt he was the reincarnation of the Apostle Paul. And that was interesting because he didn't hold the Apostle Paul in particularly high esteem. He felt that maybe he thought he was here to correct the record. But the Apostle Paul, he felt, had kind of steered Christianity away from the true teachings of Jesus. So anyway, that was kind of his take. And of course, they believe that when the body dies, the soul lives on. Myrtle believed in reincarnation. She did not like, this is the part I was looking for here, she did not favor efforts to communicate with the dead through mediums, but she did believe in reincarnation. And I'll close with this story today about the differences between how they died, Charles and Myrtle Fillmore. So Charles believed that you could regenerate your body. He believed so much in the power of the mind to heal the body that he felt that if we got expert at that, we would never die. And we would continue to regenerate our organs and cells, et cetera. So at the age of, 94, I think, when he was on his deathbed, he felt that he had failed because he had failed in his life because he was not able to live eternally in that body. Myrtle had a very different view. Myrtle, at the age of 86, was at Unity Village, healthy, walking around, doing great work, leading Silent Unity Education, did a ton of work with kids. And she just walked around one day and said, you know what? She had decided that she could be of more help to Unity from the other side. So she went around and said her goodbyes to people. She was in good health. And the next day she died. So it was like Myrtle kind of, you know, got it, right? Myrtle was ready to be from the other side and help us from that angle. So it was just very different how the founders related to that whole thing. Anyway, sorry to run so long today. I get excited when I'm talking about your questions, but I appreciate them very much. We're going to skip over the meditation since we're running so late today. I would encourage you at some point in your day to give yourself a little